Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun stepped down from the High Court in 1994. He died in 1999, forever to be remembered as the justice who wrote the majority decision in the landmark 1973 abortion rights case, Roe v. Wade. Our guest tonight has gone deep into the private papers of the man who wore the robe, transformed himself in his 24 years on the bench, and changed the nation. Tonight on Point, the life and legacy of Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. But first, we begin tonight on Capitol Hill with the latest on the Senate debate over the nomination of John Bolton. The Senate has voted this evening to delay a vote on President Bush's controversial nominee for U.N. ambassador. Joining us live now with the latest is Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Charles Babington, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
So we just heard at the top of the hour that it's been delayed. What's going on here? What's the backstory?
Very interesting development here that was surprising to a lot of senators. The Democrats have insisted on more information from the Bush administration about John Bolton's background. And they said since they weren't getting that, they would not agree to move to a vote on a confirmation vote, and that's really a filibuster. And it takes, as we know from the judge's fight, it takes 60 votes to end a filibuster in the 100-member Senate. And the Republican leader, Bill Frist, apparently thought he had those votes, but when they called the roll, he did not. They had 56 to end the filibuster, and that was four short. So now they're going to have to start renew this when they come back after next week's break.
So here we are again. We see how narrow the moderates' agreement was earlier this week. It really was just about judicial nominees and filibusters.
It was, Tom, and it's a little bit of an apples and oranges argument. One thing, they were talking about judges there. Here we're talking about a U.N. ambassador.
Right.
But also the Democrats today really tried to emphasize that they were not filibustering to try to stop Bolton from eventually being confirmed, although most of them oppose him, but to, as their only means, as they put it, to protest the administration's refusal to give them the information they want. Now, you can disagree or disagree whether that's their motive, but they seem very eager to say this is not the kind of filibuster that we were looking at judges, where the real intent was to make sure they never get confirmed.
Charles, does that ring credible? What is this classified documents on Syria that the Democrats are saying that they want to see?
In 2003, congressional the State Department was drawing up some testimony about Syria to take to Congress, and the Democrats alleged that Bolton played a role in trying to sort of doctor that information to make it look like Syria was a bigger threat than it actually was. He says that he did not do that, and the Democrats say, well, the only way we can prove or disprove this is to get background documents that, you know, about all the back and forth that was going on then. The administration has said, you know, this is not relevant to what's going on, and we don't think it's appropriate for you to have that information.
What's the voting math today? Were there any Democrats who broke ranks on John Bolton?
Yes, there were three. Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and I'm drawing a blank.
Was it Pryor?
It was, thank you.
Mark Pryor of Arkansas?
Right. Interesting that Pryor in particular was. Well, Pryor and Nelson were very much involved in the agreement on judges, and Landrieu was a signatory to that. So these also are three Democrats from states that are pretty strongly Republican states.
And what about on the Republican side? If John Bolton had been cleared for an up or down vote today or right after the recess, do they have the votes there? Has Senator George Voinovich's emotional testimony about John Bolton, against John Bolton's nomination, made a dent in his own party's view?
It appears not to have, Tom. The thinking is, from the senators I talked to in both parties, that if they could have gotten to the confirmation vote, which again would be a simple majority vote, that he would have been confirmed probably close to, you know, the lines that we saw in the 56-42 vote, although, you know, Voinovich in this case did vote to end debate, even though he says he would vote against confirmation. So you can't see that as an exact predictor. But the thinking was, if he could have gotten to the confirmation vote today, he would have been confirmed.
And so the forward game now, briefly, Charles, how long until this comes up for a vote? And do the Democrats think that they may be spiking his nomination somehow by delaying?
They say not. They say that they doubt that they'll be able to kill the confirmation. The earliest they can take it up would be June the 7th after this upcoming break. I think the only thing, if they do, number one, if they do get information, and number two, if it's explosive, I suppose that could derail the nomination. The feeling among the senators I've talked to is that that is not likely.
So John Bolton twists in the wind for a little while longer.
That's right.
Charles Babington, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. In American history, there are those few landmark Supreme Court cases that come to define an era. The Dred Scott case and the Civil War, Brown versus the Board of Education in the Civil Rights Movement, and in 1973, there was Roe v. Wade. The fight over abortion was one of the most bitterly contested cases ever argued before the Supreme Court, and that battle rages on today. Roe v. Wade changed the nation, it transformed the High Court, and it transformed one justice in particular, the man tapped to write the court's majority opinion in favor of Roe, Justice Harry A. Blackmun. Nominated to the court by Richard Nixon in 1970, Blackmun was not a judicial radical. Born in working-class St. Paul, he worked his way through Harvard Law School, boyhood friends with the court's then-Chief Justice Warren Burger. He was an unlikely champion of one of the most divisive issues in American history. Our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Linda Greenhouse, got unprecedented access to Blackmun's personal papers when they were first made publicly available. In a new book, she tells the intimate, unlikely story of Justice Blackmun's evolution on the bench and of the Supreme Court he helped shape. This hour, On Point, the life and legacy of Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. You can join the conversation. What's your recollection of, your opinion of, the man who authored Roe v. Wade? And as the High Court awaits new justices, new transformation, what does Blackmun's story tell us about its inner workings? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Linda Greenhouse. She's covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times since 1978. In 1998, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on the court. Her new book is Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. Linda Greenhouse, wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ms. Greenhouse.
So, Linda Greenhouse, there's so much we want to hear from you tonight about this singular, controversial justice, but I wish you'd, if you've thought about it, help us put it in a very current context for a minute. And what do you think, taking an intimate look at one justice like this, tells us how to think about the transition ahead for the Supreme Court, the lives these justices lead, and where the court goes next? Is there a lesson in the microcosm, in the life of one man, for how the country can, should think about the whole court and the changes coming up?
Well, gee, there's a lot of things you could say. One thing that strikes me is the extent to which people say, well, is a nominee predictable? You know, how often it's happened that presidents pick people for the Supreme Court who end up surprising them. And you know, why is that? Well, I don't think it's because nominees hide the ball, and I don't think it's because we have insufficient means for figuring out who these people really are. But in Harry Blackmun's case, for instance, Richard Nixon selected him with the advice, I should say, of a young lawyer in the Nixon Justice Department named William Rehnquist at that time. Because Nixon was looking, he was desperate to fill a seat, it had been vacant for a year, was looking for a law and order type of conservative. The complex of issues that mattered most to Nixon and to the country at the time were the whole complex of defendants' rights, criminal law type of things. Abortion, which, as you properly said in the introduction, came to define Harry Blackmun's 24 years on the Supreme Court, was just the tiniest little cloud on the horizon. I don't think that Blackmun was asked, I'm sure he was not asked a single question about abortion at his confirmation hearing. So it's just a reminder that you pick somebody who's oriented in a time and place, and if he's going to, he or she's going to serve on the court for a couple or a few decades, you know, who knows what the important issues are going to be.
The person changes and the national context, the agenda changes.
That's right.
And there we saw it with Harry Blackmun. Jack Beatty, a remarkable justice here, you know, one who famously, as I was just reading here in the Legal Intelligencer, they're saying the constitutional hero lionized by liberals and libertarians, the judicial legislator vilified by social conservatives, all in one neat package, a big, easy target from both directions.
And a man who, as Ms. Greenhouse points out, and as Stephen Breyer pointed out in a tribute to him, grew, changed. Justice Holmes said the life of the law is experience, not logic. Experience, and he was open to the experience of American women. And as Ms. Greenhouse points out, he really, it wasn't just Roe, there was a whole jurisprudence of women's rights that he helped to put into the law. And it was something he wasn't prepared for. He grew up in the man's world of the 40s and 50s, but he responded to this new historical experience and grew with it and put it into the law.
Linda Greenhouse calls Harry Blackmun, or says, he left a legacy of how to be a judge. Linda, does that mark you as a certain kind of reporter, as having a certain kind of political view, simply to say that?
Well, I don't think so. You know, it struck me going through his papers, and what I meant by that comment was we would hope that we would have judges who would come to cases, you know, with an open mind and listen to the arguments and be open to persuasion. And I should say that Harry Blackmun was not a cheerleader for women's rights by any means, and he was not among the first justices to sort of get it, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other feminist lawyers in the 1970s came before the court to argue their cases. The cases didn't really resonate with him much, and he, it took him a good long while to sort of get on that bus. And that was one thing that makes him a very interesting judge.
He sure got on in the end. Linda Greenhouse, stand by. Jack Beatty, we're talking tonight about Justice Harry Blackmun. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun and his life in the law. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your recollection of, your opinion of, the man who authored Roe v. Wade? And where do you place Justice Blackmun in American judicial history? What leads some justices to change on the court and others to dig in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Linda Greenhouse. Her new book is all about Harry Blackmun, Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. Linda, you've got to give us the story of how you came to swim in this great sea of personal documents and papers that let you write this book.
Oh, sure. Well, Harry Blackmun never threw anything away, or if he did, I can't think what it might have been. When he died, he left his papers to the Library of Congress, and everybody who was watching the court at that time knew that this was going to be one of the great Supreme Court collections, and he left it to the library with an unusually short time frame to be open to the public, 5 years after his death. Mm. That anniversary was going to occur in March of 2004. He died, as you said, mm-hmm. in 1999. So the family was rather concerned that on the day these papers open, it would just be a frenzy.
At the Library of Congress, I guess.
At the Library of Congress. Yeah. And, you know, nothing productive would really get accomplished.
And there's a huge volume we're talking about here.
We're talking about 500,000 documents that take up 600 feet on the shelves, two football fields full of documents.
Oh, boy.
Well organized and well indexed, yep, by the Library of Congress staff, who spent more than a year on this. There's a 300-page index to the collection. Anyway, the family came to me and also to Nina Totenberg. Listeners might remember, mm-hmm, the series that she did for NPR, and offered us advanced access for a couple of months, with the idea that we would not write or broadcast anything until the papers were open to the world, which, by the way, they now are. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's really interested in this conversation can go down to the Library of Congress and look at them.
And we'll talk about that. You know, the only one who's dipped in and some real controversies come out of that. But there you were with this ocean of documents. And what was the flavor that came up to you of this man? I mean, you knew him on the court, and now you're looking at all his private stuff. Did it all match up?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I knew the court, and I basically knew the court process. But as I wrote at the time, I had this feeling of kind of diving down the rabbit hole. I've been living for 25 years covering the court sort of on the surface of the earth, and now I had a chance to see what really was going on behind the scenes, both in terms of the court's decisional process, and that was my initial focus. I was kind of looking for the news behind the headlines, mm-hmm. what really happened in some of these high-profile cases. But then when I turned from that series, which ran in the Times in March of 2004, to turn it into a book and go deeper, I was just captivated by the personal material that's in the collection, the childhood diaries and the correspondence, and just an amazing amount of material that really illuminates his personal journey as well as his jurisprudential journey, mm-hmm. and tells us about him as a person.
Give us just a little bit of that early biography. You found in his childhood story some of the reason he was such a pack rat, that he kept everything, that he made carbon copies of everything. What was his early story, and how did it help shape him?
Well, he grew up in a kind of struggling family. His father never managed to make a really good, stable living. Harry Blackmun's a bright young kid, goes through high school, wins a scholarship from the Harvard Club of Minnesota to Harvard, a scholarship that pays his tuition but not any of his expenses. So he worked all the way through college, all the way through law school. And early in his life, about the age of 11, he started keeping a diary. And he kept writing in it for 17 years, all through law school, clerking, law practice, and hundreds of pages. That's what's in there. And so you see his effort to kind of make sense of his world, to record everything, every book he read, every movie he saw, every concert he went to. Mm. And I got a sense, you know, not that he thought he was going to grow up to be so important that people were going to be poring over these papers at the Library of Congress, but he wanted to say, as a young child and then a young man, you know, I'm here, my circumstances may not be the most propitious, things may be a little tough, but I'm making a record, I'm here, and I matter to myself.
I'm not just a mote that will drift away. So when Richard Nixon and maybe Mr. Rehnquist looked out to tap Harry Blackmun in the early 70s, he wasn't a young man anymore, 61. Who was the Harry Blackmun that they tapped, that they thought they were tapping?
Well, he was somebody who had acquired a lot of experience in the law. He practiced at the most distinguished law firm in Minneapolis. He was the general counsel at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And then he served as a federal appeals court judge. So he had, you know, a lot of experience and a quite a long judicial record. And when Assistant Attorney General Rehnquist was asked to take a look at this record and report back, he said, yeah, you know, it's a good record. The opinions are well written. They make sense. He's pretty conservative and non-controversial, respectable, that kind of thing. And, you know, that was basically true. But if you look at some of the notes that he took while he was working on cases for the Eighth Circuit, not things that Rehnquist would have seen, but the kind of memos he wrote to himself, you see somebody who's interested in the Constitution as a rather flexible evolutionary document, so that in terms of the constitutional discourse today, he would not have been a, you know, Antonin Scalia originalist, and that's pretty clear.
You say he came on the court at the age of 61, and instead of shutting himself up in the comfort of the ivory tower, he kept listening and learning, and with that evolving in ways that we were joking, Richard Nixon no doubt never imagined. Help us understand that kind of pilgrim's progress here of Justice Blackmun, the arc of that journey. What were the big stations of the cross that began to change his view of the Constitution of the world?
Well, one of the most interesting themes of his life's work was the death penalty, so we can take that maybe as a starting example. He grew up in Minnesota. Minnesota didn't have a death penalty, one of the few states that didn't, so it wasn't something that he was comfortable with, and he didn't like the death penalty. He was personally opposed to it. He confronts it as a judge for the first time on the Eighth Circuit, and of course, at that time, the Supreme Court had not confronted the death penalty, so it was the law of the land. It didn't fall to him as a court of appeals judge to oppose it. He struggled the whole, I'd say, first two-thirds of his judicial career with how to reconcile his personal opposition with his essentially rather conservative view of the judicial function, which was, you know, I'm a judge, I'm here to interpret the Constitution, not to import my own views as a citizen into my constitutional analysis. So he comes on the court in 1970. The big issue facing the country as a constitutional matter was not abortion. It was the death penalty. And the court in 1972 issued the Furman decision, which invalidated every death penalty law in the country. And Blackmun dissented. He said, it's not my role as a judge. You know, I may not like this, but, you know, I have to go with the Constitution as I understand it to be. So right then and there, you see the kind of a starting point, and you watch him struggling for the ensuing years, looking at the way the death penalty is working, because within 4 years, the court has allowed it to resume with Blackmun in the majority. So states reinstate the death penalty. The pipeline fills up. Last-minute stays of execution start reaching the court. Congress responds. They start cutting back the rights of appeal. The court gets more conservative. Blackmun gets more concerned. And so finally, after 24 years of this, in the very final weeks of his career on the court, he issues that famous dissenting opinion, I shall no longer tinker with the machinery of death. The death penalty experiment has failed. So it's a really interesting kind of dramatic story, I think.
And you see it as a conclusion that he reached, was it through observing the actual effect, the reality of how the death penalty was being used and unfolding, or was it Harry Blackmun sort of releasing that inner impulse that he felt somehow empowered with age or stature to say, no, I don't care what the precedent is, this is how I see it?
Well, yes, it was both of those things. I mean, by that time, Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall, who were real philosophical dissenters against the death penalty, had retired. So there was no voice on the court standing up against the death penalty. I think that was part of what was going on there. But you're right. I think it was a combination of his watching what was happening on the ground and his feeling that, okay, I've come to this conclusion, and after all these years, I'm entitled to say it.
I'm again it. Jack Beatty, we've got to come to Roe v. Wade here. Linda Greenhouse's colleague, I guess you'd say, conservative columnist David Brooks at the New York Times wrote a few weeks back, Justice Harry Blackmun did more inadvertent damage to our democracy than any other 20th century American. And of course, he was talking about this kind of charge of making law from the bench. There's the conservative critique that we're on the opposite pole from the liberal applause that we're still hung up on.
Yes, but I see in Ms. Greenhouse's book, Gloria Steinem said, you've saved more American women's lives than anyone in our nation's history. So I guess that's the picture. You know, I'm struck with how he evolved there. I mean, he starts out, as you point out, Ms. Greenhouse, with a medical look at abortion rights. You can't interfere with the discretion of the doctor, and owing to his experience as an attorney for the Mayo Clinic. But slowly, this becomes something bigger. It becomes about the equality of women. He begins to see that if women are forced to carry pregnancies to term that will either harm them or that they do not want, that in effect, I think he puts it this way, that they become sort of breeding for the state, and that this is a fundamental violation of their equality. And this is these are big words, which we don't hear much about in the abortion debate. We hear about the fetus. We hear about the wickedness of abortion. We don't hear people saying, well, is the alternative that a woman is obliged to carry a pregnancy she does not want? How can the state insist that a woman's body be turned over to it to that degree? That was very much on his mind, and it seems to me that came out of a fundamental empathy for the situation of women.
Linda, is that it? What was the main rudder of his majority opinion in Roe v. Wade?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. It started out really, if people go back and read it, and I would invite everybody to do that, it's really an opinion about doctors. That's absolutely true. And one thing to remember is that in the early 1970s, the Supreme Court itself had not yet really adopted a jurisprudence of women's rights. The notion that discrimination on the basis of sex by the government was a constitutional harm that violated the guarantee of equal protection, the court really hadn't gone that way yet. So there was no equal protection women's rights vocabulary that was really available to Harry Blackmun and these six other middle-aged to old-aged men who joined that opinion. If I can refer back just a minute to my esteemed colleague David Brooks and the first line of that column you read, that Harry Blackmun did more damage than anybody in American history or whatever.
To the U.S. democracy,
That's an ahistorical reference to Blackmun's role. Blackmun was assigned to write this majority opinion by Chief Justice Warren Burger. And he wrote it
for a childhood, lifelong friend of his who he became to have a very difficult relationship with.
He wrote it for 7-2 majority. It wasn't something that he foisted on the court or on the country. And there's a lot of anachronistic thinking about Roe. It's really interesting to go back to the original documents and to see how the abortion debate was carried out in the late 60s and early 70s when abortion appeared to many people to be a public health issue. You know, throughout history, women have had unintended pregnancies, and believe it or not, throughout history, they have found ways to terminate these pregnancies. And so the medical profession had started to reanalyze the situation, and the elites of the medical profession, among others, of course, were coming to the courts with briefs they filed in Roe against Wade and other cases, saying, you know, let's look at this as a public health issue, and let's consider ending this regime of criminal abortion laws. And so that was the discourse. And you're absolutely right. It wasn't much about the fetus and the unborn. It wasn't much about women's rights. Now, as the abortion decision...
It wasn't much about women's rights, but it was all about women's rights in the end, wasn't it?
In the end, yes. I'm talking about, let's look at how it looked to the court in the early 70s, before there was really a jurisprudence of women's rights. But then as the country's dialogue about abortion changed, as the court's membership changed, as the issue evolved in our political culture, Blackmun really devoted himself to defending Roe against Wade. He bought into this notion that it was his personal legacy. He had resisted this at first. He would say, you know, it's not my opinion, it's an opinion of the court. But it became part of his self-image. How could he help it? Because he was, you know, made to be the devil or the saint, depending on what side you were on. And one route of defense he came to see was to position it as a decision about women's rights. He came very much to incorporate that view and to describe it in those terms. But that was not the original understanding of Roe.
So, and Jack's right. That's you as well. That's very far from the center of the conversation today. Take us on a swing through this thinking one more time. Then you're saying the whole interpretation of this as a women's rights decision, was it absent from his majority opinion that he wrote up, or was that added, you know, after the fact? Was it incipient in the opinion?
It's not absent. I think it is incipient. But if you look at the key language, I think it's I don't have the opinion in front of me here, but it's about the third paragraph from the end, this kind of a summary paragraph. And it's something like, we hereby vindicate the rights of doctors to treat their patients in a way that they think is in their best interest so that a woman in consultation with her doctor can choose whether to continue a pregnancy. So, I mean, certainly women are in the picture. No, I don't mean to say that they're not. But it's a doctor-centered kind of holding in that case to a degree that, you know, surprises us today because we think we're much more in a kind of an individual rights frame of mind. But there were, you know, many, many abortion cases then started reaching the court. One of the first cases after Roe was, okay, you consult the doctor. How about your husband? Does the husband have a veto power? So then the court had to start looking, you know, get out of the doctor model and start looking at the family model and the woman-centered model. And the court quite easily said, no, it's the woman's choice. The husband cannot exercise a veto power. So that kind of starts the ball rolling as the post-Roe decisions start reaching the court over the next 20 years or so.
And, of course, he lived on for a quarter century after that decision. Did he ever come to doubt, as he saw the tremendous anti-abortion movement, that he'd made the right decision along with those other six judges? Did he ever come to second-guess it?
No, I don't believe so. And when he announced his retirement at a news conference with President Clinton and he was asked to kind of reflect on Roe, he said, in more or less exactly these words, it was a necessary step on the road to the emancipation of women. So that was his ultimate judgment, as we've just been saying, quite different from where it started, but that was his ultimate and very heartfelt judgment on the matter.
And then out of the same papers that you were looking at came this huge flash of controversy about whether or not he used his clerks too much, what role they played in writing Harry Blackmun's decisions. We'll come back and talk about that with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent reporter Linda Greenhouse. Her new book is Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you make of Harry Blackmun's evolution from Nixon nominee to maybe the most liberal member of the U.S. Supreme Court? What's the next landmark decision or reversal you expect from the Supreme Court? What would Blackmun say about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun and his life in the law. We're joined tonight by Linda Greenhouse, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. Her new book, drawn from his tremendously voluminous papers, open first to her, is Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you expect your own thinking on the big issues to profoundly evolve between your 60th birthday and your 80th? And what does Justice Blackmun's story tell you about the inner life of the Supreme Court, of the judges on that top bench? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patrick is calling from Boston. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of Miss Greenhouse and look forward to Tuesday mornings this time of year. and I was particularly interested in some of the recent articles I've seen in the papers about other people who've had access to his papers. Having been a law clerk myself to two federal judges, people seem to suggest that his clerks had far too much influence over his opinions, and there's, discussion of the clerks sort of running the show. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, just, not having seen those papers and knowing that you had taken a very close look at it, what your opinion on that was and what you took away from that.
Patrick, I'm glad you're raising it, and stick with us as we dive into it. You've been a clerk yourself. I'm interested in your feedback here. Linda Greenhouse, of course, rather famously, David Garrow at Legal Affairs has written it that this is the story of a justice who ceded to his law clerks much greater control over his official work than did any of the other 15 justices from the last half century whose papers are publicly available. He said the degree of clerk involvement is indefensible. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I'm also glad that Patrick raised this question because I read that article and I found it odd, to be perfectly honest, because here's what I found in the papers. And it was extremely useful to me writing this biography. For every case the court had agreed to hear, Harry Blackmun would, of course, prepare for the argument. And he would do it in the following way. He would take the bench memo, that is the memo that the law clerk had prepared about the case. He would take his own reading of the briefs and so on. He would take his own experience as a judge dealing with similar issues or whatever, and he would sit down in the privacy of his own chambers, and he would dictate to himself or his secretary to transcribe a memo that would synthesize this material and give his own sort of instinctive reaction to the case, indicate what sorts of questions he'd like to have answered at the oral argument, which was to occur within a couple of days, predict how he thought the court was going to come out, and just generally grapple with the issues in the case, case after case after case for 24 years. And all these memos are there in every case file. I think it's very hard to look at that material and see something other than a judge doing his own work. And you see sometimes he'll say, my clerks want me to do X, but I'm sorry, I'm going to do Y. Or, sometimes he agrees with the clerks, or sometimes he changes his mind over the course of the decisional process. But in every instance, he's there being the judge and doing it. So I have to say, I was quite unpersuaded by that article.
But what about the, I mean, we've heard the picture described of highly politicized clerks kind of driving Blackmun's opinions all over the place, inserting very deliberate, intentional, specific elements that would play in certain political ways into the issue. You don't see it there, or you don't see it as any different from what other Supreme Court justices get from their clerks, or you just don't buy it at all?
Well, I think some of his clerks were quite political. I think the atmosphere at the court in some of those terms was highly charged, and I think it's clear that the discourse within his chambers was such that he permitted or maybe even encouraged a kind of a dismissive attitude towards some other members of the court, Warren Berger in particular, his old childhood friend. And mm-hmm. so that you see clerks, not in the opinions, but in the memos that the clerks would write to him, you know, put downs of the Chief Justice and so on. And I think it's unlikely that this was a very common practice at the court. It's just an indication, I guess, of how free the clerks felt to talk this way to him. He had breakfast with his clerks every morning, and so I think they had, you know, fairly open exchange of ideas. But it's a far leap from that to say that the clerks were running his chambers or telling him what to think.
Patrick, you've been a clerk. You've been following it. What do you make? Does it look like a reasonable input or something extraordinary?
No, I was surprised to read it, having read a book written by one of Blackmun's former clerks, Ed Lazarus, and it seemed to me like he was a very contemplative justice, very hands-on, and I remember taking away from it that there was a lot of back and forth of his clerks, but more, I guess, my impression was that he really got a lot of value out of them and pushed them, so that there was a lot of discourse, not necessarily control from the clerks up.
Patrick, thanks for your call. Linda, what do you make then of this very strident attack? How do you interpret it? I don't know if you're willing to say, but what do you make of David Garrell wading into the same papers and coming out with such a sharp, sharp critique?
I don't know, really. I mean, I have a high regard for David Garrell. I think all the incidents that he talks about in his article are in my book, but I think they're in the book in a kind of a broader context. You know, you can look at many incidents in isolation and come away with a conclusion that I think wouldn't necessarily be sustained in a broader context. And, you know, beyond that, I was just kind of mystified.
Jack Beatty, it's a fascinating glimpse into how the court works, you know, who's writing what, when, where, burning what midnight oil, many hands busy in the opinions that ultimately come out.
Yes, I mean, I've heard these stories about Clarence Thomas, that some of his clerks who were members of the Federalist Societies have had a heavy influence on his opinions. But you know what strikes me? I'm just looking at a case, Kahn versus Shevin, where his clerk, Richard Blumenthal, I think is the Attorney General of Connecticut now, says, "Oh, this is a constitutional provision. It had to do with women and with widows, and how should they be treated by the law, and so on." And he rejects that. He says, "No, I think this statute is entirely sex-based discrimination, entirely irrational." So here he is rejecting exactly what the law clerk wants him to do. You know what? I spent an evening once with Justice Blackmun years ago. And it was in Washington. And what I remember about him is that he didn't talk in abstractions. And that's so rare in Washington, where people talk about things that aren't real and never about things that are. And that's all he seemed to be interested in, human beings and their problems. And when I came across this in Ms. Greenhouse's book, I wanted to cheer. He says, in an opinion, "Sometimes we, judges, overlook the individual's concerns, the fact that they're alive human beings that are so deeply and terribly affected by our opinions." If I could have any statement that every judge should have to look at every day, that would be it.
Linda Greenhouse, what about the falling out with Chief Justice Warren Berger, a friend of Harry Blackmun's from kindergarten? Why did it come to such a bad pass?
Well, it's an amazingly poignant tale. You couldn't make it up. I mean, what's the likelihood that these two guys from the wrong side of the tracks in St. Paul, Minnesota, grow up to spend 16 years together on the U.S. Supreme Court, having conducted an intimate correspondence over the decades? These two good friends, one working in Washington, that was Berger, one back in Minnesota, that was Blackmun.
It's
all
a
the
biographer's
letters were
there. Dream, for sure.
Oh, and they get on the Supreme Court, and you know, I think it was no one thing. It certainly wasn't just ideology, because Blackmun had quite good relationships with some justices that he didn't agree with. It wasn't one big case. It wasn't one blow up. It was an erosion of regard, I think, that was caused by, oh, probably a misapprehension one to the other of what they could actually expect. They hadn't worked or lived together for 20 or 30 years, although they had this very active correspondence. I think Berger had some reason to expect that Blackmun would sort of do his bidding. Blackmun had written him a letter when Berger had become Chief Justice just the year before Blackmun himself went on the court, and said to him, "My support is yours for the asking at all times." I mean, that's what Blackmun wrote, so Berger...
Right, so come on down.
Can't be blamed for taking that at face value. And from Blackmun's part, Berger had been turning to him in that first year when Berger was Chief Justice and Blackmun was still on the appeals court, asking his advice and sharing his worries and concerns about whether he was really up to the job of Chief Justice and so on. So Blackmun responds, gives him lots of advice, and he had reason to think that, you know, he'd be sitting at the right hand of his best friend, the Chief Justice of the United States, helping him run the Supreme Court. Now, that wasn't too realistic either. And they get together, and it's kind of oil and water. Berger wasn't very well suited as a personal matter to the job of running the court. He was a little imperious, a little patronizing, a little insecure, which I think sometimes is at the root of, you know, personal
many friendships
like
falling
that.
Apart, and this one finally drifting away. We've just got a minute left. Our time with you has just flown by. I've got to ask, you point out that many times Justice Blackmun doubted that Roe v. Wade would survive. Given the environment now, given the horizon that's out in front of us, what do you think he would make now of its status, of the odds of it surviving?
Well, you know, it survived its biggest test in 1992 in Planned Parenthood against Casey. And the support for Roe on the court now is 6-3. And he retired, I think, fairly confident that it would survive. And, you know, not too much has changed since then.
But the politics, and certainly of the nation, have just become hotter. And we may see many retirements and new nominees in the next couple of years.
Oh, sure. But, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist was one of the original dissenters in Roe. So for President Bush to replace him, I don't think is going to change the 6-3. And, you know, there's a long history ahead of us.
A long history ahead of us with Harry Blackmun's fingerprints all over it. And now your biography there to remind us. Linda Greenhouse, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Linda Greenhouse, author of the new biography of Justice Harry Blackmun, Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. Jack Beattie, a last thought?
That evening, I just remember what a gentle, wise man he was. I don't remember what he said. I just remember his manner. It was healing somehow.
Well, and we learn a little bit more in the echo of that tonight. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll hear from the winning lawyer in Roe versus Wade. This is On Point. In 1969, a young lawyer named Sarah Weddington was approached by a group of women from the University of Texas who asked if they would be breaking the law if they publicized places where women could get abortions, at that time outlawed in the state of Texas. Weddington didn't know the answer, but she offered to do the research and let them know. Little did Weddington know that a few years later she would be the winning attorney in perhaps the most important Supreme Court decision of the past 40 years, Roe v. Wade. Throughout the month, we've been bringing you notable commencement addresses from around the country. Here is Sarah Weddington speaking this past weekend at Pitzer College in Claremont, California.
Went to the University of Texas in Austin with 5 women among 250 in the entering class. Now it'll be almost 50% women in just about any law school. I finished law school and I could not get a job with a law firm. They would say things like, but women have to be home to cook dinner, and lawyers have to work late. How could you do both? And, as you might guess, I never got a job offer.
Now, my male colleagues did get those great jobs, and they disappeared into the back rooms of those law firms, and you have never heard of them. But because I didn't have that all-important job making great money, I went to work for a professor, and a group came to me, mostly women, some men, and said, we need help. And I asked, what? And they talked to me about how information about prevention of pregnancy was not easily available, how abortion was illegal, that California had changed its law so people with enough money could go to California, but others ended up in really bad straits. And they said, we need help. Now, as I look back, if they had said to me, Sarah, would you mind trying a U.S. Supreme Court case? I would have said, no way. In fact, when I went back and wrote the book, A Question of Choice, I said to them, why did you come to me? You knew I had never tried a case. I had done uncontested divorces, wills for people with no money and one adoption. And they said, Sarah, we wanted a woman lawyer. You were the only one we'd ever heard of. And we needed somebody who'd do it for free. And that's how I got the case. Years ago, January 2001, I got a call from Time magazine, and they said, we're going to do a special issue of 80 Days That Changed the World, and we would like for you to write the piece on 1973. I was honored. I wanted to write it. They said 1,500 words. And so I started writing those perfect 1,500 words. And then they called back and they said, the war's going to start. This will be in the March issue. The war's going to start. 1,000 words. So I had to cut it. That was painful. And then they called back and they said, the war is starting. 300 words is all you get. And so I tried to think, what can I say in 300 words that would make a difference? And I had a collection of old buttons. I had one that was a coat hanger in the middle with a flash across it. Red across around it. And so I was wearing that button on an airplane one day, and the flight attendant kept looking at my button, and she would look, and she would go past, and she would come back, and she would look again, and she would go. And finally she stopped and she said, what do you have against coat hangers? It reminded me of the lessons of history. They are sometimes important. I've been so fortunate. Had lunch one time in Arizona with Barry Goldwater Sr., who said the true conservative position is it's not the government's business. I've met a lot of other people who came from many perspectives, but who thought individuals should make the most important decisions for their lives.
Sarah Weddington, who represented Jane Roe in the landmark Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade, speaking over the weekend at the Pitzer College commencement in Claremont, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.